We almost have self-driving cars. Like, why don't we have self-driving drug development?
Health and biotech news a tech bro or sis would find interesting. We're all bringing some source from the week. On today's docket, we've got why don't we have more AI designed drugs? And Satya Nadella, Microsoft CEO, has entered the group chat with a GPT-infused health tech play. Quick intros for everyone. We've got Adam, the Jordanian juggernaut, back to bless us with the worst takes on every issue imaginable. He's the co-founder of Span Health, which was acquired by 8sleep, and a longevity doctor, which basically means if you want to pay someone 10 grand to tell you to take a statin and exercise, then he is your man. We've got Imran, the professor of poise and eloquence, ex-doctor, ex-McKinsey, co-founder of Nye Health, and now a consultant and angel investor. So basically, he steals from the rich and gives to the poor.
Okay.
And I'm Musti, I'm a doctor and make big picture medicine. Imran, do you want to start with the AI drug discovery story?
So billions of dollars have been pumped into AI drug development startups, right? People have been talking about this now for decades, that, you know, artificial intelligence is going to change drug development. We've all heard the statistic that it costs billions of dollars to develop a new drug. I was reading this really interesting article in the MIT Technology Review, where there's an 82-year-old patient called Paul in Vienna, who basically reached the end of line on all of the available treatments for his cancer. So he was basically terminally ill, had no treatment options. He was super frail. And the doctors that were treating him, they enrolled him in a study, which was sponsored by a UK company called Exscientia. And they basically took some of his cells from his cancer. They put them into a test system, and exposed those cells in parallel to like dozens and dozens of different cancer drugs. These are drugs that they wouldn't have been able to try in real life because he probably would have died before he reached the end of a treatment course. And what they found is that there was a specific drug made by Johnson & Johnson that nobody would have conventionally tried in this type of cancer. And when they looked at the drug under basically a camera on how it worked on the cells from his tumor, they found that it actually caused like healthy changes in the tumor cells. It was working in treating the cancer. So they started treating him with that drug. He went into remission. You know, his life was saved, if you can put it that way. So they started treating him with the drug. His tumor went into remission, and he, you know, according to the article, is now doing great. This is actually not his real name, but for the purpose of discussion, I think it's fine. So I think this is an interesting example of how artificial intelligence is actually being used to change treatment plans and to actually save somebody who has otherwise terminal, untreatable cancer. I think it also raises an interesting question about why AI hasn't actually had a greater impact on drug development, given, you know, billions of dollars has been pumped into this space. So I thought it'd be a good one to bring to the discussion.
Can I just ask, where's the AI in this? Well, where was the AI used? Was it used to find candidates, like the small molecules?
Yeah. So this is the type of, as far as I understand it, this is a type of what they call phenotypic screening. So basically what's happening here is it's just simple photography is being done on these cells under the microscope. And then there's basically changes in the appearance of the cancer cells as they're being exposed in parallel to these different drugs. And so being able to like see the changes over time and to correlate them with improvements or deterioration in the cells is, I think, where the AI is coming into it.
Imran, is that AI? Because it sounds like they've kind of done a time lapse. And I mean, because it's kind of like this question of, you know, is a calculator artificial intelligence, and, you know, how long is a piece of string? But is this true AI technology?
Yeah. So I guess it is.
If you're like detecting changes, right? That's AI. But I mean, I guess it doesn't matter really if it, like, what you call it. It's pretty cool, I think. I like Monte Carlo brute force ways of doing things, and I think this is the right way of doing it. Like, if there's this other startup started by Matt Kaeberlein, who is like a longevity researcher. What they're basically doing is they have this, like, they have a name for the machine. I can't remember the name, but they basically have this huge machine with compartments with mice in them, right? And they give the mice different molecules, and they can test like hundreds of molecules with cameras. They detect changes over time, and they basically can test hundreds of molecules on these mice and see if anyone has an improvement in their lifespan, and then they can narrow it down and start testing more and more.
Exactly, and I think this is, there's, they're kind of like, we can come to this part of the discussion in a moment, but there are basically like competing paradigms in this AI application in drug development. So some of them are taking exactly the kind of approach you described, where you're looking at the phenotype, you're looking at like the manifest behavior or the appearance or the shape of the cells in this case. And there are other approaches where which are more reductionist. You're taking like one aspect of drug development, like for example, how a small molecule, like a chemical drug, will interact with a protein, and you're modeling that in a chip. So a great example of a company doing phenotypic screening is Recursion. Recursion is a publicly traded company, and their secret sauce, their platform, is their ability to basically, you know, in parallel test thousands and thousands of different cell cultures being exposed to different molecules or drugs. And then the AI piece, your point about time lapse is well taken, but the key thing here is that the algorithms are actually analyzing the changes, the very, very subtle changes in 2D or 3D that are happening in these cells, the extent of those changes, the characteristics of those changes, and they're determining, like, you know, if these are significant or not significant. That's actually where the name of Recursion comes from, because they're looking at cancer cells and they want to see if they can recurse the cell back to a normal phenotype after exposure to these drugs.
Wait, do you want to give some of the big picture of the AI drug discovery space? Because I don't want to be overly skeptical, because obviously this is an amazing development and props to them. But I guess this quote comes to mind, which was the Peter Thiel quote, which was something like, we were promised flying cars and instead we got 140 characters. And it seems like in this kind of fits into that AI drug discovery story that you've told, where we might be expecting that AI is going to find all of these new novel compounds that, instead of, you know, mining the rainforest for these new drugs, AI will be coming up with thousands and thousands of new ones. And it seems like this is a more of a incremental development. It's not really the stepwise change that we might expect from AI. So can you give some broader context of how AI is being used in the drug discovery space? And am I just being too skeptical?
No. I think we can look at the impact in a few different buckets, right? So the quickest and simplest way to bring a new treatment to a condition is actually to take a drug that we have relatively good safety and, you know, human data on, which are often previously approved drugs, and repurpose them, right? So repurposing is basically where you say, we have an existing drug which is known to treat disease X, and we're going to take that existing drug and show that, you know, it has potency, it has efficacy, it can treat people in condition Y. And that type of treatment decision can actually be much more quickly made or determined because the characteristics of the drug are well understood. So that's bucket one. You then have bucket two, which are like taking existing drugs that are in development and increasing the odds or increasing the speed of their progress through the developmental pipeline. And then bucket three is like finding the kind of golden egg, the new drug, the new target, the new pathway, and, you know, going de novo through that pathway using AI. So this is definitely like a bucket one example. There are some other actually high profile examples. So during COVID, in the very early days, Benevolent AI, which is one of the early movers in the UK, from the UK, which is an AI drug development company, found, I think through literature search and databases of like known interactions between drug and disease pathways, a drug called baricitinib, which is a drug used to treat rheumatoid arthritis, I think principally. They found that it had positive impacts on patients with COVID. It could reduce inflammation, it could reduce the risk of death. And in fact, one of the big research studies from the UK, the recovery trial, found that the death rate in patients taking baricitinib went from 14% to 12% in the patients that were studied. It doesn't sound like a huge change, but conceptually, this is like a massive, massive breakthrough. And actually showing those types of impacts in the context of a pandemic very, very quickly is a very, very powerful piece of research. So overall, you've got these sort of three paradigms. Now, one of the really interesting things about drug development is if you look at like where the gains going to come from, there's a really interesting chart here that we can throw up on the screen, which is from Professor Andreas Bender. He's from Cambridge University. He's a specialist in drug development. His research basically demonstrates that most AI systems will either claim to increase the speed, reduce the cost, or increase the quality of the decision-making of what goes into human trials. So if you think of those as like three separate levers to improve drug development, it turns out that the vast majority of gains that will come in drug development are not from cost reduction or speed increases. It's actually on improving the quality of decision-making of the drugs that go from the early stages of development in the lab through to human studies. So taking the right candidates into humans, that's where like the vast majority of the gains will come from. And the example of basically looking at, you know, the impact on an actual biological system, in this case, it was cells, that's the piece that AI is not very good at. And the reason that AI is not very good at determining how drugs will perform in human cells in patients is because biology is just inherently super, super complex. And there are so many unknown unknowns about how drugs act in the real world that you can't model on a silicon chip.
So I think what Musti is trying to say is we were promised a cure to cancer, and what we got is a bot that writes Twitter threads.
Yeah, bot that writes Twitter threads.
That's like AI in a nutshell.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that. I think they're like the most interesting thing about the story is like the personalized aspect. That they used this technology in one person. They were able to find the best molecule for this specific person. This might not benefit large numbers of people, the same molecule, but this approach can probably lead to a step change in the long run.
So Imran, why isn't it as easy as just putting all of the information or knowledge base that we have about drugs and interactions, etc., into a silicon chip and allowing the AI to go crazy on it, and then it comes back with, here are 100 new compounds that will work, or here are 1,000 current compounds that we already know about that will be effective in treating this cancer. Why isn't it as simple as doing that in the real world?
It boils down to the fact that biology is just inherently very, very complex, and we can't actually model it computationally that well. Let me give you an example. Let's say, for example, you have some data on how a drug behaves in a patient, right? Now, if you're trying to like label that data, one of the key prerequisites for like AI and machine learning is you need good quality data and data that's labeled. So a machine needs to understand the significance of pieces of data that are supplied to it. Now, if you have a patient and you have data on the drug's performance, it's very, very difficult to like disentangle and to accurately label the patient's medical state, the patient's other drugs, the actual impact of the drug on the patient's health and well-being, and to account for all of those, the comorbidities, the dosing, and so on. So biological data is just inherently like very, very dimensional, very, very complex, very, very difficult to label. So it becomes difficult to provide good data sets for these machine learning models. That's why I think this phenotypic approach is quite interesting, because in a sense, it's treating the cell or the patient a bit like a black box. Like, we don't really know why the drug worked in that patient, but what you're doing is you're kind of taking an end-to-end approach where you're saying, let's just expose like this living organism to these molecules and then see on an end-to-end basis how the shape of the cell, how the performance, the function of the cell is changing, rather than going through the reductionist approach, which requires really highly, you know, labeled and really accurate data.
Like cancer, it's even more difficult because the cancer itself is a living organism. Think of it as a population of different kinds of cells. If you attack, if you're successful in destroying one kind of cells, the cancer responds and evolves and develops resistance to these treatments. So it's extremely difficult to predict the response of something like cancer, even if you find a molecule that works on a certain number of cells.
Yeah, I think it's probably also worth just like very briefly looking at the difference between chemistry and biology. So when you look at chemistry, like we know the chemical structure of like molecules through their crystal structure. We know like how their physical properties behave. We know how those molecules behave in different temperatures, you know, when combined with other molecules. Like that's predictable. If I tell you, like, I did a chemical experiment in my lab, you can recreate that chemical experiment in your own laboratory pretty much with the same results. Think about all those, you know, as a simple example, all those experiments we did in high school. Biology is, like, much more different because, as Adam says, even in a tumor, you'll have multiple, like, you have, like, a heterogeneous tumor environment. So you'll have different almost versions or iterations of the tumor in every cell. Secondly, like, every cell in the human body has, like, a different proteomic environment, different metabolomic environment, transcriptomic environment. So you have like all this dimensionality in biology that's very, very hard to control. You know, cells can be extremely sensitive to like the precise assays and the instruments you're using to test them. So it's very hard actually to replicate biology and to reduce it to like laws and, you know, behavior that can be very well predicted is very different to chemistry. So I think we're seeing progress happening in chemistry and intermolecular interactions being modeled. In biology, you know, you get drift in biological systems. You know, they're not static in time. Like if you take a time series of a cell, you know, hour by hour, the internal state of that cell will change. It will evolve. Chemicals are not like that, right? Like you can take a powder off the shelf. You can take a, you know, molecule if it's reasonably stable, and you can predict how it's going to behave tomorrow.
Yeah, and even inside a cell itself, one cell itself, you have different pathways, and these pathways react differently to when one pathway is blocked or one pathway is modulated. You upregulate other pathways, and that itself is poorly. We don't really understand it that well, and we also don't understand the second and third order effects. So it's just really complex, and I don't think modeling that environment will actually produce that many like promising results in pharma. I think it's more. I like the phenotypic approach, which seems to take into account that lack of understanding and that black box of what biology is.
Yeah, and you're what you're touching on there is this like interdependency within a biological system, right? And you change one bit and then everything else can change. And I think when some people have asked like why we have like almost have self-driving cars, like why don't we have self-driving drug development? And I think that you know, the interesting thing about like self-driving cars is that it's a difficult problem, of course, but the dimensionality on what you can predict from your observed behavior is much lower. Like our ability to predict behavior based on observation. Yeah,
even self-driving cars is a good example here, because the reason why we don't have self-driving cars yet. Why is that? Because the margins turned out to be much more difficult than expected. It's easy, or like relatively easy, to model 90 or 95 or 99% of the environment. But it's that 1% that is really difficult in self-driving, and it's the same with biology.
The positive spin, at least, on modeling a complex system or trying to make sense of this all is that you were hinting at this, Imran, but there's the empirical approach to medicine as well, where you don't necessarily need to understand exactly what's going on or the exact mechanisms at play. One really prominent example that I read a paper on a while ago was that paracetamol, or I think the Americans call it Tylenol, it's one of the most common, probably the most common drug used. We still don't understand how exactly it works or how exactly it causes pain relief. We have some theories on that, but hey, we have loads of trials that show it's safe and it works. So in some ways, it's not actually that important to understand the nooks and the crannies of like exactly how everything's working. As long as we know it works and we've got trials to show that, then, and it's safe, that's okay as well.
Yeah, metformin is the same.
Okay, yeah.
I thought Twitter has solved metformin. I think, by the way, I think longevity doctors need a rebrand, because I think every time someone mentions that someone's a longevity doctor, it just makes me think they're a quack.
I agree. So my training is in internal medicine and oncology, so I should probably start with that and then say I'm interested in longevity. I changed my bio to say I'm an MD that's interested in longevity instead of being a longevity doctor.
Okay. Yeah. Or performance doctor, human optimization doctor. I don't know.
It's the same thing, I think. Yeah. I mean, no, the thing is, kind of lay people might think it's a real thing, but like you don't get respect from your peers when you say longevity.
But your peers don't give you money as well. They
don't
pay you.
Why aren't all doctors longevity doctors? That's what I want to know. Like, shouldn't everyone be here to like make me live a bit longer?
Exactly.
It's true.
There are actually a couple of dozen of like drugs in development in trials that have been designed in part by AI. So I think in the next few years, we'll actually see some of these coming to market. We'll have readouts from these trials. It'll be good to see if there are improvements on like how well these drugs perform, how safe they are, and so on.
Okay, awesome. So I'll do my story of the week, which is that Satya Nadella, the Microsoft CEO, has entered the group chat with the GPT-infused play in the health tech space. So GPT-4 is OpenAI's new large language model. People used ChatGPT, which was actually the earlier version of GPT 3.5, and that actually became the fastest growing consumer app of all time. So it reached 1 million users in, I think, 5 days. That was quicker than Instagram. That was quicker than anything else that we've had before. So Microsoft, I think, has been super smart and has partnered with OpenAI. I initially thought it was an acquisition, but it's not. They've partnered with OpenAI and they've started infusing GPT-4, which is this incredible AI technology, into all of its product base. So that includes things like Bing, Word, Excel, everything else you use in Microsoft, and stuff that people crucially already have installed on their computers, they're already using. Another arm of Microsoft is that they have this other company called Nuance, and they have this product called DAX Express. And this is a tool that's already used by 500,000 doctors and clinicians. And what they've done is they've put GPT into this. So they've just been like, get it into my veins, inject GPT into all of our products. And essentially, the easy way to think about this is that it's going to turn into like an Alexa or a voice assistant for doctors. So you go to your doctor, you chat to your doctor, and they actually spend a considerable amount of time documenting that and writing right. the notes. There's a study that showed that doctors, at least in the US, spend 35% of their time on documenting and writing notes, which is a gigantic waste of time. It's incredibly important, but it's not the best use of their time. So what this will do is that it will listen to the conversation, and it won't just transcribe it, but it will, in a very smart way, using the AI, make that conversation into a coherent set of notes that the doctor and patient can take away. So I think this is super, super exciting and a game changer. Do you guys have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, it is a considerable amount of time when you finish with a patient, you need to document, you need to request any tests, you need to do all the admin stuff. And usually you have like four or five logins, four or five different softwares that are really clunky to use and super non-responsive. But the problem is a lot of those softwares that we already use that are clunky and we hate are Microsoft products. So I don't trust Microsoft to make like really
Adam,
nice.
Is that still the case in your fancy longevity clinic? Don't you have like a nice MacBook Pro with some fancy EHR on it?
I'm talking about NHS. I'm talking about NHS softwares. But even the like the good softwares or the better softwares like Epic, for example, is a pretty good software. Even that is just like super non-intuitive, and they don't use like an iterative, user-centric approach. So that would be ideal if someone can listen into the conversation, create a letter, create all the stuff that a plan that you agreed on, and then all you have to do is authorize. That would be great.
So this is a classic Microsoft move. If you think back to what happened in the Slack and Microsoft Team wars, basically Microsoft has this massive installed base. They have this huge footprint, as you pointed out. They can drop a product into that installed base and bundle it basically for free, which is what they did with Teams. And the worst thing about this actually is I think it kills competition and innovation for the end user. I actually am very skeptical of organizations that use Teams. Every time I get a calendar invite and there's a Teams link and the invite, it like makes my heart sink because I find it such a painful and terrible user experience. I used it last year in an organization. It was a disaster compared to Slack as an example. But because they're just bundling these things in for free, I think it's killing, it's removing actually other people's lunch. It's not even eating it. It's just like taking it away and taking it off the table because of the bundling. I actually think that this is going to be used by lots of physicians. If you look at the NHS as an example, I'm sure most healthcare systems in the US are running off Microsoft Outlook and Microsoft Office. I don't know if they have like Nuance software in there, but there'll certainly be bits of this technology creeping into other parts of the workflow. And it potentially is gonna muscle out other products that are maybe more thoughtfully developed or designed. I think, you know, there's been a huge flurry of transcription products, prototypes, demonstrators on the internet since GPT 3.5 was released. So I think a lot of those companies are actually going to struggle because as a provider, if you're faced with a free product from an organization like Microsoft where you can vouch for the safety and the privacy of that product because you know that they'll have the resources to do that properly, you know, it's a difficult case actually to reach into your pocket and to pay for something unless it has to be sort of 10x better or, you know, really transform your work compared to something which has been given to you for free.
Yeah, and if they're all using GPT-4 anyway, they're probably not going to provide anything that is like 10x different than the Microsoft products.
Yeah, and to build on what both of you are saying, I think that we were promised that with GPT-4 and other democratization of this kinds of technology, the fact that anyone can plug into the API and start using these kinds of tools in their products, we were promised that we'd see, or there was a hope at least, that we'd see massive advances in innovation and a flurry of new startups. But yeah, building on what you've both been saying, it looks like this democratization of the technology means that actually all the big incumbents and all the big players who already have distribution, already have brand value, already have integrations into electronic health records, what it means is that overnight they can just wipe out any competition and become the leader. So really, it seems like there's just going to be more of a consolidation in the space and less competition, which is not really that cool.
I mean, that's true for enterprise software, but I think for direct-to-consumer, I mean, I don't think that's true.
The other thing I think that's interesting here is that Microsoft feels like it's changing in real time. You know, historically, Microsoft did not have a reputation for shipping super innovative, like high-velocity product developments. But now it feels like every week or two, you know, you've got with this GPT-4 implementation, you've got this product suite that like a significant proportion of the knowledge economy is using that are about to get augmented all at the same time, like just like that. Like we've been talking for years about what will the impact of artificial intelligence be on the workforce and so on. It's literally playing out in real time, week by week in front of our eyes. And it's really surprising that Microsoft is at the frontier of that because I just would never have thought that their product teams would actually pull that out of the bag. I also think Microsoft, you know, their M&A decisions in recent years, including buying Nuance and many other acquisitions that they've made, and you talked about the recent investment in OpenAI, like you have to take your hat off to them because, you know, they've done that whilst basically more or less, I would say, staying out of the press with the negative stories that have hit companies like Meta, Amazon with workers' rights, Google with privacy issues and so on. You know, Amazon has kind of got under the radar and is in gaming. They've got the GitHub acquisition. They've got this OpenAI partnership. They're taking over in the healthcare space with Nuance. So it's just really impressive.
I spoke to Shiv, who's the CEO at Abridge, who's essentially a competitor to this. So they're making like another version of Alexa for doctors. They've raised over $20 million for this. He gave me a really interesting framework, a way to think about health tech. And I wanted to get your two thoughts on this. So I basically said to him, are you not scared that with GPT-4, that any kid in college who's handy with a computer can basically whip up a competitor to you overnight? And he said, no, that doesn't scare me at all, because although on the outside it looks like the technology or making the cool demo that does something like this, that takes the conversation a patient and doctor are having and makes it into these really coherent notes, looks like the hard bit, the actual hard bit is everything that follows. So you can whip up a cool demo at a hackathon, but the hard bit is, again, getting the EPR integration, getting regulation, getting cloud infrastructure, getting building the brand and getting distribution. So I wanted to ask you two, as both health tech founders, did you notice that in your own experience, that from the outside it looks like the tech or the product or the big sexy thing is the hard bit, but actually it's the in the weed stuff, the follow-on stuff, that actually is the make or break for a company?
Absolutely. That's true for any company, but it's even more true for enterprise software companies. And when it comes to AI as well, you need to, we need to appreciate how important the iteration is and improvement of your data set is. So if you have a proprietary data set that you have access to, and you're training your model on a large number of users, then that's proprietary data that a startup doesn't have access to.
Yeah, I think there's two questions here. One is like, you know, a serious and like well-funded and talented startup team fighting off like hackers in their bedroom. And yes, I think they're going to be fine there because at the end of the day, like, you know, clinical users especially will be extremely intolerant of like failures in a product. It's really, really easy to build a demonstrator. It's really hard to build like a stable service that's used at scale by hundreds of thousands or millions of users and is like reliably and predictably performing as you expect. The place where the competition is going to like hit companies, even venture-backed companies that are small but growing fast, is when they come up against the enterprise juggernauts that are giving away these types of products for free or at a relatively lower price, and they already have a lot of the capabilities in the back end around the stability, the privacy, the safety, the HIPAA compliance, and so on, that these smaller companies are having to fold into their product development from scratch. And, you know, it's just going to provide, it's just going to make it like harder for them to iterate than, you know, you can't move fast and break things in healthcare, right? You have to still have to be quite careful. So I think they're going to face a lot of headwinds from the larger companies. I don't think the hackers in their bedroom are going to build serious companies in this space. Not unless they really commit to.
I would always bet on a hacker in their bedroom. To be honest, I mean that's literally the like the type of person who goes to YC and builds the next Airbnb.
I think if you build this team and the support, and you spend the time on the implementation, and the service itself is a good quality, that's fine. But I don't think, like, you know, 1,000 flowers, you know, blooming at the same time of like half-baked products is going to threaten a company that's taking it seriously.
And Imran, do you want to use one of your Harvard degrees to talk about the health economic or the macro context of this? Because we've got a situation in which we've got an aging population, no thanks to Adam. We've got a greater health burden. We've got a greater burden of health disease and, yeah, basically just health. And we've got then finite financial resources or even decreasing financial resources. So it seems like all the game-changing uses of AI in health are going to be things that increase health productivity. That seems like if you're doing that, you're going to do well. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so, because, you know, there are different ways to look at this. But one is that we just have a limited number of skilled healthcare workers, and we have a population with an increasing burden of need because they're getting older, they're living longer, they're carrying more comorbidities with them, throw in things like the pandemic and all of the backlog. So we need tools and technologies that are going to increase productivity of physicians and also enable relatively lower skilled people to do the work that previously was, you know, exclusively for the more high skilled people. So these types of changes will overall increase the productivity of the system. They'll ease some of the bottlenecks around talent. And that is what's gonna enable us to provide the care that we need.
Absolutely. Shall we close off then? I thought we could go over some audience feedback. Got two bits of feedback. So I've got one bit of positive feedback and one bit of negative feedback. So someone said, very stimulating discussions, well articulated. So well done, guys. Good articulation. And then another person just commented morons with a crying laughing face, and morons was spelt wrong as well.
Okay, that makes you feel better.
Yeah, that's that one. So we're building somewhat of a fan base, I think.
Clearly.
I mean, maybe we can ask audience for feedback, like just give us like constructive feedback in the comments.
Yeah, it'd be useful to know which stories or which topics work well and what people enjoy.
Awesome.
Okay.
I've got a child knocking at my door, so I'm gonna have to drop, I think. Yeah.
See you later.